Okay, so it's a pleasure for us to have Peter today here, that he will tell us several things about Hadron Colliders. Specifically, he will tell us also if there is if the possibility of building a collider in the sea it's feasible. So we're very happy to have you here, and thanks for giving this talk. You can go ahead anytime you want. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks for inviting me to talk with you. I would like to take this opportunity to offer you a perspective on the inside ingredients that comprise a Hadron Collider, both colliders that have been built to the present day and the gleams in the eye about what might be done for the future. This is a very timely moment for that. European community has authored just this past spring its vision for the next several decades of high energy discovery on their map, and the U.S. is correspondingly engendering a snowmass process that is aimed to do the same from its perspective. So it's a good time to be trying to assess that and to look at the notions that have been put forward for Hadron Colliders, to in some sense ground those notions in what we know about what it takes to build one and make it work. I'm going to do this in a context in which I'm going to summarize three optimizations of the main features of a Hadron Collider that would aim toward embodiments for the future. One of those is the one that you know pretty well by now, I imagine, the CERN's conceptual design for it's what it calls FCCHH, an alternative to that that might be significantly more affordable and feasible in the near term, sort of an option of where one might go to push to the farthest one can the reach for discovery of new gauge fields. I'm going to begin this by giving you context about the Hadron Colliders of up until the present day. Hadron Colliders have been the primary engines for discovery of the particles and gauge fields of nature during the past two generations. That's kind of summarized in this graphic that plots on a semi-log scale, appropriate for the purpose, with the running coupling constants, the collision energy as a function of time that has been produced in existing Hadron Colliders, and the discoveries that have been made at those colliders, and the luminosity that was used to make those discoveries. Starting with the W, and I'll zoom in on each one of these in turn in a moment, but just in this larger picture, the W discovered in 1980 with a mass scale of 80 and 90 GeV. That was done with a center of mass energy of 540 GeV and at CERN in the SPRS. The Tevatron in 1995 discovered work at 175 GeV, the heaviest particle yet found in nature, with a integrated luminosity of about one femtobarn. The Higgs was discovered at 125 GeV at LHC at an energy of 7 TeV and with an integrated luminosity of about 20 femtobarns. Since that time, CERN has almost doubled the energy of the LHC to its full design energy, and has accumulated 1,000 inverse femtobarns of integrated luminosity. But alas, no further discoveries have yet been made. So as one looks to the clouds of the future, one has to then ask in this plot, what do we reach for, and what are the prospects for achieving that for an affordable cost within our lifetimes, and to make the reach that it gives us sufficient that there is some good likelihood that, like the astronomers of the present day, each time they build a new telescope, they discover spectacular new surprises in nature, in the heavens. So too, we would hope that as we push our frontier of collision energy, Mother Nature may have delightful surprises for us of new gauge fields and particles. So that's the context. You need four things, basically, to make a hadron collider. You need a ring of superconducting magnets that guide the beams in circular orbits. You need a tunnel that can safely contain the magnet ring and provide access. You need a control of beam dynamics to sustain high luminosity. And you need detectors to identify interesting events and to record all possible data from those interesting events. So that's kind of an overview. The way this played in the first of the Hadron Colliders was at the beginning of my career. At that time, the picture of the weak interactions led to a near certainty that there must be a unification of the electromagnetic and weak interactions, and that the particle embodiment of that would be gauge bosons, the charged W's and the neutral Z. Exact values of the masses were pretty well available from the absence of weak neutral currents, but no accelerator then extant had enough energy to make those discoveries. So that was really when I see from your pictures, I've not met most of you, perhaps any of you, but I see from your pictures on your little icons that most of you look to be postdocs, certainly early in your career as physicists. Well, when I was early in my career, I spent a year at CERN as a visiting scientist, and I was entranced with the ideas for beam cooling that, in my way of thinking, made it conceivable to actually make a cold beam of antiprotons that would make it possible to make colliding beams between protons and antiprotons in the then existing colliders. I carried those ideas back to Fermilab when I returned there as a professor in the U.S. And in 1976, I put forward the specific idea, the specific vision to do those cooling techniques, make an antiproton source, and make proton-antiproton colliding beams in the existing main ring at Fermilab, which of course could also be done in the SPS at CERN. That's an interesting thing to hark back to, because it's an instance of using ingenuity rather than very large amounts of money to extend our reach for discovery of new gauge fields. The ingenuity was to use existing rings of particles in existing tunnels and to to push that energy frontier dramatically by making collisions of matter on antimatter in that one existing machine that had been used as an accelerator heretofore. Well, in year 2000, we knew that the electroweak interaction required another gauge field to give mass to particles, and hence the Higgs boson. It was discovered with 6 TeV collisions in LHC, those collisions had a potential mass reach out to a TeV. Like the case, as in the case of the weak bosons, we had a specific gauge field prediction that we were striving to find a way to reach in experimentally creating the particle spectrum of that new gauge field in collisions. So we had a quantitative target for the collision energy that it took. In the case of the weak bosons, it was the 540 GeV of SPPRS and the 2 TeV of the Tevatron. In the case of the Higgs, we didn't quite have as much specific predictive power for the mass scale. It really needed to be somewhere in the range 250 to 1,000 GeV. In the simplest picture of a Higgs sector, the mass would actually be down at, it was predicted by one of my colleagues, Dimitri Nanopoulos and Keith Olive and others, that the mass scale for that might be 125 GeV. That turned out to be prescient, as you know. And that was their prediction of that was obtained by constraining a triple convergence of the running coupling constants. Well, LHC, in order to make that possible, niobium titanium superconducting magnet technology to its limits at a cost of about $5 billion. It installed it in an existing tunnel, just as the weak bosons were discovered by the by making proton-antiproton colliding beams in existing tunnels. With rings of eight Tesla dipoles cooled with superfluid helium. And that brings us up to more or less the present day. The energy has again been doubled, and so the CERN now operates at its design energy LHC of 14 TeV. During those intervening years, we have striven to make reach of make use of that energy reach to probe for the conjectures of supersymmetry or supergravity and of other gauge fields that have the tantalizing possibility of making a link between the domain of astrophysics of dark energy and the domain of the gauge fields of nature. That vision has so far proved illusory, however. Sparticles, if they exist, should have been discovered at LHC within the reach in energy and luminosity, unless, and there you get into the sorts of things that folks at places like Perimeter make their bread with, the flood of precise data from astrophysics suggests that gauge fields of nature may be more complex, may involve extra large dimensions, strings and membranes, etc. So we don't know what that what such a future may hold from Mother Nature, but and furthermore, that means that we really have no, unlike those previous episodes, we have no firm basis to make a conjecture that if we only could marshal the technology and the money to build a collider of a certain energy, we really ought to find a new gauge feel there, or else Mother Nature is more cantankerous than we would hope. We don't have that luxury this time. And predicting the energy for discovery is perilous. And I'll give you a specific example that is before your time, but I watched it play out episode by episode. After the discovery of the B quark in 1977, we knew that there should be a companion top quark, but we couldn't predict its mass. Predictions grew during the 1980s, and with those predictions, the limits of energy for trying to discover them, from 20 to 40 to 80 to even 120 GeV. And there was a plethora of theoretical models in each case, and pushing what was possible at in experiments to inform those theories. Here's the part that's really very painful. There were no fewer than four E plus E minus colliders, complete colliders, built during the 1980s, with the top discovery as the stated primary goal for that. If we only can build double the energy again, then we will almost certainly find this this top quark. They all failed. Finally, the top was discovered at the Tevatron with a mass of 175 GeV. So we have to then retain some humility in this game. In the search for new gauge fields, it's entirely possible that history may repeat itself as we conjecture, oh, if we can just reach 100 TeV, or if we can, whatever number you put in that slot, we will surely find new physics. So how do we make this public case for the investment that it would require to build a new Hadron Collider? The answer is really both simple and very, very hard. We must make the mass reach, that is to say, the energy reach of the collider, as big, and at the same time, the price as low as our ingenuity can manage. So that's the context for what I'm going to be talking to you about. The cost for a Hadron Collider is driven by two parameters, the ring of superconducting magnets and the tunnel that safely contains them. The driving terms for the cost of the superconducting dipoles is, first of all, the materials that go into them, the superconductor. The choice of superconductor is dictated by the requirement that it must operate with high current at the design field that you choose. So you, as the designer of this machine, bravely choose a magnetic field strength that you want to operate the dipole magnet set. Furthermore, as soon as you go beyond the constraints of niobium titanium, if you wish to push to higher magnetic field, all of the other superconductors that would reach to those higher fields in its performance require in situ heat treatment of the windings at high temperature in controlled environment in order to produce the high performance properties in the superconducting windings. That's an immensely expensive and complex thing to integrate into the whole task of designing and building a superconducting, a long body superconducting magnet. Bottom line is, it has never been done in magnets of the length required for a collider dipole. Challenging of these constraints coming from the dipoles, however, is associated, if you go to pushing to high field, is to control the immense Lorentz forces that act upon the windings. The Lorentz forces are the magnetic forces acting back upon the winding by the magnetic field that the winding produces. That force increases like B squared, as in freshman physics. And so it reaches the limits of the strength of materials for the superconducting wires, for the cables that we make of those wires, for the electrical insulation that insulates the turns of cable within the winding, and within the structure that has to hold that winding from deforming as the magnets are ramped from low field where a beam is injected to high field where collisions are made. The other cost driver is the tunnel. The tunnel must safely contain the ring, and it is bored in strata of rock. The Mother Nature, if you've ever studied geophysics or geology, you know that the strata of the Earth is composed of strata of rock that are laid down in many cases by sedimentary processes and others by the terraforming that occurs during plate tectonics. In that overall concatenation of processes, however, the strata of rock are layered and the layers are tilted. And this is true almost everywhere on the Earth's surface. Layer thicknesses are typically 10 to 20 meters in thickness. And they have tilt angles that are such that there are transitions from one rock type to another rock type every few kilometers as you move along. So if you were to make a borehole down into the ground to explore what kinds of rock you would find as you bored vertically down, you would hit a different kind of rock every 10 to 20 meters. The rock would change quite dramatically in character from one layer to the next. Some rock types enable good tunneling with self-supporting mechanical properties and rapid tunneling rates. One example is soft limestone. Some rock types are very expensive and dangerous to tunnel in. And for that, again, it's before your time, but when the tunnel for LEP was bored and the 27-kilometer tunnel at CERN, which was then later used as the tunnel for LHC, they hit completely unexpected and very unpleasant and dangerous surprises as they made that tunnel. They encountered underground rivers with highly porous rock that they had to then freeze with liquid nitrogen in order to freeze to ice the water to enable them to try to force a lining onto the walls of the tunnel. It was a dangerous operation and it cost lives. The expense was very considerable, as I'll show you in a moment. And the same would be true in spades in the tunnel alignment that has been suggested for an FCC-HH. So let's examine some options for how to maximize the physics and at the same time minimize the cost of a Hadron Collider. So we'll look at the questions of what is the minimum cost per TeV, an interesting unit of measure for superconducting dipoles. It's not usually expressed quite that way. And we will look to see if we can identify tunnel sites where the entire tunnel could be bored in just a few favorable rock types. So those two criteria would enable us to address those two dominant features of the cost picture for a Hadron Collider. And let's also look to see if we could push yet further with collision energy and luminosity without a tunnel at all. So that's the sort of landscape we'll be exploring. Let's begin by looking at the properties of superconductors. For the purposes of their use in superconducting magnets, they basically divide into three domains. This shows a plot of the whole wire critical current density in commercially made superconducting wire. It's a little bit of a complicated plot, lots of information on it. And this is a function of, on the horizontal axis, of the applied magnetic field. So the thing to realize here is that in order to build a successful superconducting dipole for a Hadron Collider, you need to use a superconducting wire that at the field you're hoping to operate, it has a current density of the order of anything from about 800 to 1,000 amps per square millimeter. If you don't have that much current density, then the winding the quantity of superconductor that would be required becomes really rapidly unfeasible. The magnet windings become very fat in their thickness, and very inefficient in producing magnetic field in the center of the dipole that would be used to bend the proton beams in a circular orbit. So you need, in guiding your eye in this complicated soup of data, you need to stick with the top third or so of the graph in order to be dealing with the territory where you can build a magnet from that superconductor. So the region here that's has a background color of green is the domain of niobium titanium. The current density of niobium titanium is this plot that you see running down here at 4 degrees Kelvin, liquid, the boiling temperature of liquid helium. And you can see that it's really gives you a useful current density only up to about 6 or 6.5 Tesla. That was the design field chosen for the SSC. The Tevatron was designed to operate with 4 Tesla. And RIC before it, or at the same time, more or less, was designed to operate with 3.5 Tesla. LHC pushed the superconducting magnet technology of niobium titanium to its ultimate limits by a trick. They cooled the superconducting magnets to the temperature of superfluid helium, 1.9 Kelvin. That enhances the current density in the niobium titanium wire quite significantly, and that enabled them to reach to the 8 Tesla of the LHC design. But that was truly the end of the road for niobium titanium from the point of view of trying to push to higher fields for a dipole application. So as you want to go to higher fields, up to something of the order of 14 Tesla, at the very most 15 Tesla, is the domain of niobium 310. It is very different superconducting system. It's an A15 alloy. It's sort of almost an intermetallic in its crystal structure. And it is has a considerably higher upper critical field and upper critical temperature. So it can operate with the current densities that are required for a collider up to something of the order of 14 or 15 Tesla. Whoops. The pushing to 16 Tesla is problematic for niobium 310. Its current density is diving pretty quickly, and it begins to require a problematically thick winding to reach it. Another feature of these conductors is running along up here at the top of the graph. Titanium has a price as a superconducting material in the form of fine filament wire for making a magnet of about $200 a kilogram, depending on the exact properties you want. Niobium 310 costs about 10 times. That's 10 times as much per kilogram. Then you can apply that factor in trying to get your head around the prospects for building a ring of superconducting magnets from that considerably expensive material.
And just to be absolutely sure, so this niobium 310, I guess it's not, is it proof technology in the sense that has it been used in any collider before?
Yes, it has. Not in the dipoles. It has been used in the quadrupole. It is being used in the quadrupoles that will soon be installed at LHC for the high lumi upgrade. Those quadrupoles use niobium 310 in their windings, and they are the first real success and beachhead, so to speak, of moving niobium 310 technology into a first maturity for use in a hadron collider. Keep in mind, however, that the total quantity of supernutting quadrupoles required for the high beta quads low beta quads of the LHC lattice is about 1% of the magnet length that's required for the dipoles, and the same would be true for a future Hadron Collider of FCC or others. So yes, there is a first beachhead just now coming into maturity for bringing niobium 310 into practice in magnets that will actually operate in a Hadron Collider. That's a very big step forward. It's has been a great collaboration between the U.S. and Europe and Japan in maturing that technology, and now building that fleet of several dozen supernothing quadrupoles. The third domain on the right here is sort of highlighted in pink, is the domain of high temperature superconductors. The conductor bismuth 2212 and the conductor REBCO, or rare earth barium copper oxide. Those materials open the domain to very significantly higher magnetic fields. And the red curve here shows the case for the niobium titanium that we talked about, which can take us up to about 15 tesla, but not higher. The dotted blue curve shows the case for 2212, bismuth 2212. In principle, it would make it possible to make a collider up to magnetic fields of 30 tesla or beyond from the point of view of the performance of the wire. Likewise for REBCO, in the orientation, REBCO is strongly orientation dependent in its magnetic, in its superconducting transport properties. When the magnetic field is parallel to the face of a thin foil tape of REBCO, it can carry just amazingly large current densities in the superconducting layer. When the field is turned perpendicular to that, however, and remember, in a dipole, the magnetic field fringes as it's passing in the field that's presented in the winding. The critical current drops by a full order of magnitude. And so it can be used to good benefit in solenoid magnets, where the field can, everywhere except at the ends of the solenoid, can be made parallel to the tape face. A tape winding. In a dipole, it's a much more problematic proposition. And the cost of both, at the present day, of both 2212 and REBCO is ruinously expensive. It's $20,000 per kilogram. So as you go from green to yellow to red in this plot, each step you increase the cost per kilogram of the superconducting material that you would be hoping to use in magnets by a factor of 10. So that's a very important fact of life to keep in view as we then consider magnet design. So now, looking at magnet technology per se, there have been exactly two superconducting dipoles fabricated to date, short model racetrack dipoles that have been successful in reaching 16 tesla. The one was built at LBL, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, the magnet called HD1, about 60 centimeters long in its body. And you can see it here. It's a racetrack geometry winding. There is no open aperture at the ends of the winding that could accommodate a beam going through the dipole. So this is sort of a first step exercise that one engages in to try to take that first brave step to show that you can actually build a winding and get it to hold together and operate at a design field before you take on the additional challenges of flaring the ends of the dipole and other matters that would make it, that would move down the trail to an actual collider dipole. So that magnet was successful way back in 2002 or thereabouts. And just a couple of years ago, there was another racetrack dipole shown here, made at CERN, the RMC dipole, which again successfully reached 16 Tesla. Those are the only two short model racetrack dipoles that have ever been operated successfully to 16 Tesla. There is a very vigorous and well-funded set of programs going on at CERN, at five or six different laboratories around Europe, and at three national laboratories here in the U.S. aim to try to develop many different coil geometries and many different approaches to how to mature this technology. So that's the present state of development of a push towards 16 Tesla dipole technology as one milestone that one might hope for. The motivation in that really comes from CERN's vision for an FCCHH. This would be a 100 kilometer circumference tunnel that would swing around behind. I think most of you have probably visited CERN, and many of you have probably enjoyed climbing on the Salève, the massif of a fold of mountain between the Rhone Valley and the Alps. And so, as you can see here, the suggested alignment for an FCC tunnel would swing around on the far side of the Salève from CERN, which is over here in the foreground. It would swing underneath Lac Le Mans and also underneath the Rhone River in a great big circle with a tangent point at the LHC. that conceptual design for a site is very strongly limited by the surrounding mountains and lake. It requires 16 Tesla magnets to reach a milestone of 100 TeV collision energy. As you've just seen, no one knows how to build those magnets successfully today. And the superconducting wire that would be required if a magnet technology were to be developed that could do that and work successfully with present prices for niobium-310 would cost something of the order of $20 billion. And that's just for the wire. That's not for the magnets. That's just the wire. The tunnel, scaling from the costs of the LEP tunnel from the early 80s, and that's a very dangerous extrapolation because the site that you can see here is a considerably more diverse one with a much more heterogeneous set of strata of rock types and going under lakes and rivers. So frankly, tunnelers kind of, that's a very expensive tunnel to look at in the world of tunneling. And so that would cost some number of billions of dollars. The ultimate reach for discovery of new gauge fields, this is really in the province of you folks at Perimeter and your colleagues around the world to look at the connection between the mass reach of a given collision energy of protons through the running coupling constants and the many layers of intermediate processes that lie to whatever gauge field that you conjecture. You could reach perhaps to 7 TeV, or in some other cases to perhaps 40 TeV. But we have no credible prediction for where that mass scale, whether that would be a fit to what Mother Nature may have as a next gauge field or not. So we want to, what I want to now explore with you is how we could try to extend reach for new physics with a large circumference site with low tunneling cost and a modest field strength magnet with low dipole cost. This shows the LEP tunnel built in 1981 at a cost of $11,000 per meter. The small white circle here shows the site of the SSC that was once under construction here in Texas near Dallas. This is the center of Dallas right here. That site lies entirely in two of the world's most favorable media for tunneling, the Austin Chalk and the Taylor Marl. The actual delivered tunnel costs, so the finished tunnels for the 35% of that tunnel that were completed before the SSC was canceled as a project, was $3,000 per meter in 1992. So you can project, you can compare these two in a cost projection to the present day or to the future, and you can see that this is, in fact, the world. This is, I mean, in quantitative fact, if you go to the lore of tunneling technology, you'll find that the tunnel contracts for the SSC set world records that have never been broken to the present day for the tunnel advance rate, 45 meters per day, and the tunnel cost of $3,000 a meter for finished tunnel. No one has ever beat those numbers for any tunnel for any purpose in the right up to the present day. So this is a truly nice exemplar of how you can minimize the cost of a tunnel. We have looked at the possibility to extend the circumference of a Hadron Collider tunnel in these same very favorable media, the Austin Chalk and Taylor Marl, staying within those strata. You can see the stratigraphy in this, it's called a geological map of Texas. Staying within the favorable geology, you can locate a ring of 270 kilometers circumference. That is, in fact, has a touch point with the SSC tunnel. Well, now let's talk about magnets and their cost. The ultimate niobium titanium magnet was the magnets for LHC, ultimate in the sense of high field, pushing to high field, what you can do with niobium titanium. This shows the pattern of magnetic field in the dual dipole of LHC and the details of its inner structure. It was pushed to 8 Tesla using superfluid helium, but that came at a price. The superfluid helium cryogenic complex for LHC cost as much as the ring of superconducting magnets. The R&D path that's presently being pursued that I was telling you about in the U.S. Shown here in many winding geometries. They have some things in common. They have many, many layers and many turns in the windings, and they have very high stresses on the fragile superconductor. So that's a brave and challenging R&D trail. We asked the question, how could you try to probe for an optimum cost per TeV for a Hadron Collider? There, the sweet spot of that in the world of magnets and colliders that have been built to date was actually back in the early days, the RIC collider at Brookhaven. It has only a single layer of superconducting cable in its magnets, and it has a minimum quantity of superconductor. In the development of that and then subsequent development of higher field niobium titanium magnets, a systematic analysis of cost drivers that go into determining what ultimately a dipole will cost was done. And it shows that there are really two fairly predictable drivers. Number one is the number of turns of superconducted cable in the dipole, and that's really the measure of the touch labor it takes to build it, of highly skilled, very tightly quality controlled touch labor. And the other is the cost of the superconducting wire and cable itself. So if we compare those criteria for LHC, for RIC, for FCC, and for a technology I'm going to show you in a moment, you can see that the number of turns depends strongly on the field strength. As you go to higher field, it takes disproportionately larger number of turns of cable in order to make the windings. And the superconducting area increases similarly disproportionately as a convolution of the data I showed you before. Likewise, the TEV per 100 kilometers, meaning the performance, improves, but now you have to look at the trade-off between cost and performance. So if you now convolve these two cost drivers into your own version of a measure of cost and the bottom one into a measure of performance, it can lead you to realize that this RIC technology at very low field actually produces the highest, for the dipoles, the highest performance per cost of any of the steps along the way. The question marks here for number of turns and area for FCC are obvious. It's still in its R&D infancy, and so there are no credible cross-sectional models that with a commercially available superconducting wire that have been made that can reach the 16 Tesla that's required. So here is the optimum that we came up with of a sort of driven by that reasoning I just presented to you. Here is a 4.5 Tesla dipole containing just a total of 20 turns of superconducting cable to produce that 4.5 Tesla. It's in a very simple geometry as a dual dipole. It has a side channel integrated within it to take synchrotron light in a separate aperture at a higher reservoir temperature, something that becomes increasingly important as you go to higher and higher proton beam energy. A ring of those magnets put into this 270 kilometer tunnel would provide a 100 TeV hadron collider. So that is a way to use a very conservative, low-cost magnet technology, minimize its cost by minimizing the number of turns of cable and the quantity of superconducting wire that's required in the cable to reach the required performance and put it into lowest cost tunneling that is available. This cable and conduit conductor is a round conductor of a kind that's been used in superconducting magnetic energy storage and in the coils for tokamaks for many years. It is a single layer of niobium, in this case for niobium titanium wires that are cabled with a twist pitch around a thin oil tube in the center that acts as a spring. This shows the perforated spring tube in the middle. This shows the cabling machine that cables them around. This shows wrapping and then pulling into the sheath tube and finally drawing the sheath onto the cable to make a stable confinement and support of all of the wires within. The cable can be formed into the windings to make compact end windings, something that's a very significant challenge for Rutherford cable windings of the conventional sort that are being pursued for 16 Tesla dipoles. The cable is manufactured industrially today in 150 meter lengths for a cost less than twice what the cost of the actual superconducting wire in the cable is. So if we compare cost projections in those down those two trails, the best one can take an exemplar design, even of a hybrid coil winding block coil to reach 16 Tesla, and compared those to the case of this low field, large circumference option, you can see that both the superconducting magnets are inexpensive and the superconducting and the tunnel are inexpensive, so that the total aggregate cost of both the magnets and the tunnel has the flavor at such a gleam in the eye stage for a Hadron Collider be not really outrageous to project towards something that we might be able to persuade the world to fund us to build. On the other hand, building magnets from niobium 310 or even going further to high temperature superconductors pretty rapidly leaves the domain of the demonstrably affordable and makes the enterprise more than risky. Well, now that we're thinking big, let's see what the ultimate Hadron Collider might look like. And I will hasten up because I've been moving slowly. Suppose we were to throw away the tunnel altogether and put the ring of superconducting magnets in a cryostat pipeline that is simply a curved pipeline, curving as a circular pipeline on itself, and make it neutral buoyant in the sea, and then put it at a depth of about 100 meters below the surface. This would give us a collision energy, if we use a magnetic field in this, of about 3.5 Tesla, and made a circumference of 1,900 kilometers, in effect inscribing the Gulf of Mexico. Would produce collisions with 500 TeV collision energy and 5 10 of the 35 sustained luminosity. There are lots of things to say about this. It's a very different way to conceive of a Hadron Collider, to put it mildly. The notion is to realize that we know how to build pipelines in the sea. We know what they cost. They are not prohibitively expensive. And the remarkable fact is that the LHC itself, as a ring of magnets in its cryostat, is actually approximately neutral buoyant. If you were to take an LHC magnet in its cryostat and put it in the sea, within 10%, it would neither sink nor float. It would be approximately neutral buoyant. So this is not a pushing in some artificial way design, the conceptual design of such a system. This shows what it would look like. Here is a dual dipole of the magnet design I showed you a few minutes ago, using the cable and conduit with just 20 turns of superconducting cable, niobium titanium. This is the room temperature vacuum enclosure, the cryostat for that. Each magnet would be built as a 300 meter long unit in a facility at the port where it was nearest to the site you choose for the project, and taken out to sea as a straight line unit, lowered into the sea. It is sealed as a hermetic object with a hub for its interconnection to the next hermetic dipole string. And the connection of these and the finishing out downhole would be done by remote operable vehicles. No human being would go below the surface of the waves to assemble the ring of dipoles, to commission the collider.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? How do you ensure alignment? Because here, I mean...
If you'll wait a moment, I have a slide coming that addresses that. There are many lively questions that will immediately pop to your mind. Well, what about a detector? Those are immense, huge.
Yeah.
On there too. Well, this shows the actual CMS detector inside of the actual vault that it, spherical vault that it lives in underground at of sea. CMS has a mass of about 14,000 tons. And in its 30-meter diameter double hole, 30-meter diameter hole in the ground, if you think of replacing that hole in the ground by a double hole spherical bathysphere, the CMS detector within that bathysphere would be approximately neutral buoyant in the sea. So it would simply be connected as another, in a sort of tinker toy fashion, to the succession of dipoles at the locations of the intersection. To install these, you would use a container ship. This is a standard issue container ship. Container ships have a 300 meter straight side on them. You buy yourself a container ship, you load a whole stack of 300 meter long dipoles on the deck, each as a sealed hermetic unit. You take them out to sea and lower them into sea one at a time, install them at depth using ROV. Let's move on to some questions, including the one that you just posed. The ring is held in position and alignment in the sea using active station keeping and terrain following. How do you do that? There is a standard piece of marine technology called a marine thruster. If you've ever gone on a cruise ship, I don't recommend that you do it in the future in the age of COVID. You will know that as a cruise ship comes to its port and comes to dock to disembark passengers and bring on the new crew, it seems to sort of magically move to the side. As it approaches the port, it kind of comes up to where the port is and then moves, sort of sidesteps its way over to where it connects to the wharf. That's done by means of a set of marine thrusters. They're mounted on a 360-degree bearing on each one on its top, so they can be rotated to deliver thrust in any desired direction. The thrust they deliver can be controlled continuously. They are efficient, powerful ways to steer and control a ship or any object that's sitting in the sea. So at each of the half-cell locations of the collider, one of these marine thrusters would be located and used to precisely control the location of that half-cell and to stabilize it in the presence of ocean currents, et cetera, et cetera. I'll show you the currents in a moment. They are well within the capacity of marine thrusters to control with a pretty modest overall power requirement. They're manufactured in a routine way and are used worldwide in shipping. This shows the pattern of currents in the Gulf of Mexico as one candidate site. The currents out in the Western Gulf are very benign. The loop current that makes the Gulf Stream comes up between Cuba and Yucatan and loops around and goes around, skirts around by the coast of Florida and then up the East Coast. The currents out here in the Western Gulf are modest in magnitude. Here is a chart of, or a plot of, the vector velocity at 100 meters as a function of time through an entire year. And they really never exceed about 1 meter per second. When a hurricane goes right over the, another thing that might leap to your mind is, hurricanes plow through the Gulf and do terrible destruction in New Orleans and in Mexico and in Houston, et cetera. We have the data for the ocean currents at 100 meter depth as Hurricane Katrina went overhead, as the hurricane that devastated Houston went overhead, so to speak. And in each case, you practically cannot see a change, a modulation in the seawater currents at 100 meter depth. The hurricane is a surface and air phenomenon. It does not affect the pattern of ocean currents down at 100 meter depth.
Can I ask you a bit more precise question regarding the thrusters and precisely this point that you're saying? So it's a centimeter precision enough for a tunnel that will be 19 800 meters?
Let me address that here. You would then control deflections at the centimeter and millimeter scale. You use the pattern of marine thrusters to control positions at the 1 to 1 meter scale, and that is within scope of an actively controlled circular array of marine thrusters at each of the half cell locations on the collateral lattice. For small scale fluctuations, you use the same techniques that are used in a collider that's in an underground tunnel. The tunnel at LHC and the tunnel at Fermilab and all large collider tunnels actually have lunar diurnal variations in the geometry of the lattice and vibrational modes, etc. Those are controlled using active feedback with sets of deflection dipoles that are located in correction packages, again, at each half cell. And so, in effect, what that enables you to do at that fine scale is to do what's called terrain following. You make the magnetic equilibrium trajectory of the particles in the beam be exactly the physical trajectory of the center of the, as you go around the, through the aperture of the magnets of their magnetic center. And so that you can control all the way from Hertz scale to and millimeter scale up to provide the necessary alignment for long beam lifetime and high luminosity.
I see. So the idea is that it's like a thick tunnel, and then the beam itself inside, I mean, the tunnel may move, but the beam remains aligned.
Yes, the tunnel may move by very small motions,
right?
Millimeter to centimeter motions. The beam within is guided, however, so that its equilibrium is faithfully following to the level of microns, the center of magnetic field, threading through the sequence of dipoles and quadrupoles.
I see.
Last but not least, and I'm running to my limit of time, and I will then be done. There is a remarkable thing that comes to pass when you push up to the energies of 100 TeV to 500 TeV. The beam dynamics in the actual particle beam becomes synchrotron radiation dominated. Synchrotron radiation becomes something that's not merely a dominant heat load for the cryogenic system to have to try to remove from the magnets, but it also does synchrotron damping of the beam emittance in the same way that it does for an electron positron collider. So this shows what happens in the case of a 500 TeV collider in the sea. This shows injection to that collider. You're injecting fresh beam, the beam emittance, as I'll show you in a moment, decreases with time. So the luminosity actually increases with time. And you now can put a second filling of particles in, a third filling, and a fourth filling in what we call bottoms-up stacking, roughly every 6 hours of collisions. That has the potential to enable you to sustain a continuous luminosity that is of the order of 5 × 10⁵ as a function of time, more or less indefinitely.
Can I ask, does that heat up the water? What happens with beam dumps?
The total absorption of energy from any of the various parameters you might want to consider, the up to 50 megawatts of heat that has to be removed from synchrotron radiation, in the side channel of the photon stop that's integrated into the lattice of dipoles I showed you, the dumping of energy in the event that you the beam parameters are spoiled and you have to abort the beam, you have to put it in an energy dump in a local location where you do that beam is extracted and the ocean then becomes that. All of those energy release mechanisms are amazingly benign when the absorbing entity is the sea around you. It's in the degrees centigrade kind of scale. For
what about life? What about animals that are water is maybe fine. What about defensive stuff?
100 meters depth is a depth at which there is approximately a minimum of sea life, also a near zero of human activity. So it's a place where you can at least conceive of putting a circular collider that does not endanger sea life on the one hand, does not complicate life with human uses for shipping and fishing and the many things that humans use the ocean for. There is sea life in at great depths. There is sea life in the life zone of the top 50 meters or so of sea. Down at 100 meter depth, there are creatures that dive to much deeper depth, but they're passing through by and large, going back and forth between depths down to the bottom and up to the surface. So it's a depth at which there is minimum impact on the life zone of the sea, on the human activities of, that use the sea, et cetera, et cetera. That's not to say zero, and if this were to have traction as a concept, there's all sorts of things one would need to do as very detailed and thorough studies of all of the many directions of questions that one would ask. But none of them has what you might call an amber or red flag associated with it from the point of view of impact. So if you compare this collider in the sea with LHC, just as a benchmark of what we know, this collider in the sea has about 5,000 half cells in its circumference. LHC has about 1,300. So it has about four times more half cells than does LHC. The number of turns of cable on all of the magnets in the collider in the sea is about 100,000 turns. The number of turns of cable on all of the dipoles in the LHC is about 100,000 turns. So those aspects of fabrication cost and reliability that go with magnet ends and with number of turns of cable are really quite comparable between this collider in the sea on the one hand and LHC on the other. It's just stretched out a lot. Until now, we've had always a credible prediction of mass scale when we propose a new collider. In 1976, we proposed proton antiproton colliding beams because we had a benchmark of what we felt we could find with them. In 1980, we proposed building the SSC and then the LHC to find the Higgs boson. We had a benchmark of where we could, what we hoped to expect to cover with that mass reach. So far, we have no such convincing signals from the supersymmetry or other gauge field at the 14 TeV that we have access to. And the mass reach grows less than linearly as we increase collision energy. So how do we make the public case for such a huge new investment in our field? And I hope I've given you food for thought about how there are possibilities to make the mass reach as big and the price as low as our ingenuity can manage. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Peter. This was a great talk, very insightful. Are there any more questions?
Yes. So about cost. So one of the advantages of the LHC facilities is you already have CERN there. So there is a lot of existing infrastructure.
Yes.
Yeah. So here that would require starting from scratch.
Yes.
And designing new. So how much of a fraction is that of the total cost?
Well, you know, you could ask what was the cost of LHC, what was the lifetime cost of CERN. The likely costs that are associated with an FCC, a specific FCC-HH vision mm-hmm. are, in my own opinion, problematically large compared to the costs you're citing. So that the benefits of doing this at CERN, which would be marvelous, it's not clear that they are in scale to the new cost that would be accompanying the brave approach to a tunnel and the brave approach to a superconducting magnet technology that would both be required in order to take a next step at CERN.
Mm-hmm. Do you mean that the injection circular rings that you would need and so on, there would be an order one fraction of the cost for this project?
That would seem to be the case. Getting out of the brass tacks with any of these things, mm-hmm. We really don't have a level of information that can enable us to intelligently compare costs. We don't have a credible magnet technology for 16 Tesla, period. We don't have, I don't think, a credible cost for a tunnel that would thread beneath the around behind the Selev and under the Lac Leman and under the Rhone River in CERN. So we certainly don't have a credible cost for what a collider in the sea would cost from the point of view of the staging of a collider as a circular pipeline. Those are all things that would require a great deal of R&D in order to begin to bracket the costs. And one thing we do have mm-hmm. sound basis for costs on is the cost for three and a half or four and a half Tesla superconducting dipole using niobium titanium in a cable and conduit with just 20 turns of cable. And we do have a sound basis for extrapolating the cost of a 270 kilometer tunnel if it were built in the favorable rock strata that encircle Dallas, Texas. That's not to say that that's a unique site in the world. Indeed, there may be sites in Canada. There may be sites in Europe. There may be sites in Asia that where a similarly favorable geology for a tunnel of the order of 270 kilometers circumference could be identified. We strove to identify such sites here in the United States. We found only two or three in the whole country. But nothing of that sort is ever unique. There are always Mother Earth is bounteous, and there are multiple examples of just you have to ask the right questions for how we go about minimizing costs, both for magnet technology and for tunnel costs.
Mm-hmm. Where do you imagine the point is where it becomes cost efficient to do collider in the sea versus your example of doing order 300 kilometers in Texas? I mean, obviously, if you want 1,900 kilometers, you're not going to find that very easily. But right. At what point does putting it in the sea make sense in your mind? I mean, at this
point? Well, it's an interesting question. If you go back up to here, one notion that came to me would be you certainly need an injector for such a machine. So if you were to sort of go down the rabbit hole of trying to see what trail might enable you to step by step scope out a technology for a collider in the sea, you might start with a circular ring of magnets that's some hundreds of meters in circumference that would be located in a nearshore facility that makes it simplifies a whole variety of obvious issues, does not make collision energies that are interesting for physics, and indeed it needn't make collisions at all. It could simply be a storage ring to, so to speak, flex the muscles of the technology. You could put into that 3.5 Tesla or 4.5 Tesla dipoles of the cable and conduit version that I showed you, and you could actually run beam through that machine for a, I won't call it a modest cost, but certainly for a very feasible cost, to explore in practice a number of the kinds of cost drivers and many of the questions that you and your colleagues have astutely asked during this talk about alignment and about control of positions and one thing and another, and operating in a hermetic environment under sea and accessing with remote operable vehicles. All those things could be addressed with that modest footprint thing. With a bit of forethought, you could envisage that becoming, being staged as an injector to a circular storage ring that would be, and that could ultimately be the injector to this large circumference collider in the sea, and take to a next stage a machine that, for example, could be a 100 TeV collider. The 100 TeV, taking the case, for example, in parallel with the same juxtaposition with the one circling Dallas, would require a circumference of 270 kilometers. And that would actually put into practice this notion of a circular collider in the sea with the 100 TeV collision energy performance that is hoped for from FCC. And if that were successful, this larger scope orientation would enable you in this case, in the same fashion that one of you just asked me about a moment ago, of building upon the existing infrastructure at CERN, building upon what would then be the infrastructure of 100 TeV, and this machine would then serve as the 500 TeV. Next generation. The map you see here, by the way, is a topo map of the sea, so to speak, a bathymetric map. And the red highlight here is the sea bottom at the locations that are at 100 meter depth. So that gives you the depth profile of the Gulf of Mexico. This abyss is about 7,000 meters deep.
How big of an injector beam would you need for this type of 500? What is the minimum requirement for the injector beam here?
Typically, you want to for a near superspheric magnet geometry, as the one that I showed you a moment here. This the field geometry in this is. The steel is only mildly saturated in this magnet, so that it gives excellent homogeneity over a large dynamic range of operation. So taking LHC as an example, LHC has injected at half TeV and accelerated to 7 TeV, the Tevatron injected at 100 GeV and accelerated to 1 TeV. 10 to 1 to 20 to 1 is typically the dynamic range that a collider can sweep without overdue strain. So if the collision energy is 250 TeV per beam, then the accelerator that would be feeding it would need to be 10 to 25 TeV per beam.
Okay. What is the time scale for all this? Because it looks like you need to build another, a tiny LHC to feed this, like twice the LHC energy to feed this machine.
the time scale for any of these things from the present day at the present rate of development of ideas is truly imponderable, because the ideas that I have put forward to you here have no traction from the high energy community or the accelerator community. Just a moment. I'll get to where I wanted to go here. For example, this technology for these dipoles, we have built and completed dipoles of this field strength with this this field geometry, not for a hadron collider, but for an ion ring that was designed for the nuclear physics world for their the Jefferson Lab's proposal for an electron ion collider. That was a 4 Tesla superconducting dipole that we designed for that purpose. But building this into credible technology for a collider is a path that has not yet begun. So there is no timeline for it. A timeline only comes when there is a next level of buy-in by a community that says, well, we want to take this seriously and proceed. At CERN, there is no credible timeline for FCCHH. CERN, as best I understand their strategic plan, aims to focus priorities on an electron-positron collider for as a Higgs factory, either as a circular collider in a tunnel such as this one, or as a linear collider in the form of CLIC or the layout that the Japanese are proposing, et cetera. So there is no timeline associated with any of these things for a Hadron collider. In effect, the European plan has consolidated again around the priority for foreseeable future motion toward construction to be focused upon an electron ion collider, period and stop. Long-term visions and technology R&D that they might be associated with them are the only context for an HH embodiment of an FCC.
Mm-hmm. So the beginning of your talk, you seem to have definitely laid out the picture that the strategy for FCCHH probably is not cost optimized in any sense. But going back to the old examples you gave, there's a lot of progress always by reusing existing tunnels.
Oh, yes.
A very nice parallel.
Yeah. A very nice parallel in the fashion that you refer comes from, let's see if I can find the right place here. Just a moment. Here we are. LHC reused the tunnel that was built in 1981 for LEP. And with that as the driving term, the choice by CERN of 8 Tesla for its dipole field was an entirely appropriate one. It pushed to the technology limit what could be done with niobium titanium superconductor in order to achieve the maximum possible collision energy in the existing tunnel circumference. It didn't look to build a new tunnel. It looked to do that in an existing tunnel. Entirely reasonable and appropriate thing for CERN to do at that time. The present day is a bit different. There isn't an existing tunnel or FCC. The tunnel that's there is, just a moment, I'm sorry to ask this I use so quickly, but the tunnel that's there is this one. The white tunnel there, that's the LEP tunnel now used for LHC. And this is at least one candidate alignment for the FCC tunnel, swinging around just shy of the Jura Mountains and around behind the Salève. So this is using the LHC as an injector, but the tunnel for FCC is an entirely new affair, built in rather hostile terrain for tunneling.
Yeah, I just was going to say, in terms of the lesson of reusing existing tunnels, I mean, it seems like there's two options, that we either have to definitely build a bigger tunnel or do something like Clarion to see if we're doing hadrons. But what about the option for muon colliders, where they talk about reusing the LEP tunnel for a muon collider, like Vladimir Shiltsev at Fermilab has a proposal to do a 14 TeV muon collider in the LEP tunnel. So, I mean, I guess those kind of two parallels, like we either have to make a bigger tunnel or we have to not use hadrons.
Right. A very good question. There are basically two strategic trails that you can try to examine for a muon collider future. The one is to build a very high performance source of cold muons by making muons in fixed target collisions, the same way antiprotons were made for PBARP, and cooling them using ionization cooling. The MAP project here in the US, as I'm sure you know, devoted a decade of hard work to trying to develop a conceptual design that would go in that direction, and made some interesting progress towards it. It did demonstrate for the first time experimentally ionization cooling in the mice experiment at Rutherford. And it came up with conceptual designs that with a sufficiently extreme set of parameters could potentially yield a high luminosity muon collider with TeV or even few TeV collision energy. So that was a tantalizing prospect. When you drill into the approximately five succeeding layers of cooling that would be required for accomplishing the cooling of phase space sufficiently rapidly to feed muons into a collider with each succeeding tick of the clock of the gamma boosted lifetime of a muon. They are very ponderous parameters. And in the end, there was a decision made, here in the US at least, to throw in the towel on the program of R&D that would be required to mature that succession of cooling steps to credible proportions for taking seriously as a basis for a project. That's not the same thing as saying that it's not possible. It just says it's extremely difficult. I am myself an enthusiast of muon colliders, but I also know pretty well through a succession of layers of peeling the onion of those cooling methods that it is a very, very challenging proposition, and one that to reach a meaningful demonstration that it was either not feasible or not feasible would require billion-dollar scale R&D. And I mean that billion-dollar scale. And that really was the daunting prospect that led to the MAP project being canceled. The other way you can do muon colliders in principle is by an electroproduction route colliding off of particles at high energy on the fly and producing a beam of not terribly cold, but enough to work with muons circulating in a machine that enables you to make collisions. That's the scheme you're referring to of Shiltsev. The luminosity, unfortunately, that in the bravest of frontiers that I am familiar with would be attainable going down that route, is several orders of magnitude less than would be required for a program hoping for discovery of new gauge fields in the TEV regime.
Thanks.
So we are going over time, and yeah, we have been asked to finish these talks in 90 minutes, so we are right on time. So unless there are any more pressing questions, I don't see any hands up.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah. So it again, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a fantastic talk. Personally, I found it extremely interesting. So I hope that we keep hearing about this. We keep hearing more about these ideas in the future.
Sure. And you have my email address. Please, any of you who have thoughts about this, send me your thoughts. There is a very important dimension to this that you have the potential to be a central player in, and that is articulating, informing the conjectures of what collision energy scale may be required for the spectrum of conjectural models for the gauge fields of nature beyond what we know of.
Well, 500 TeV sounds fantastic. 1,000 is even better. 2,000 is even better. As high as you can go, we'll take it. That's the bottom line.
Right. Long ago, before about the time I was born, Enrico Fermi actually wrote down, and he was famous for writing down little pin doodle diagrams of things, and he wrote down a pin doodle diagram of an accelerator, particle accelerator, that would circle the Earth in orbit. And so that would be sort of obviously a further conjectural step that you could amuse yourself with.
Yeah, those will be beyond neutral buoyancy.
That's right.
Let's just say that 500 sounds great.
Yeah, 500 pounds to start with, as high as you can go. That's the bottom line. I mean, that's the bottom line, I'm afraid.
Yep.
Right. All now, right. All bets are off right now, honestly.
Yeah.
With all bets being off, however, I would urge you to be tickling this frontier as you engage in your conjectures about alternative gauge models, etc.
Okay. Do you want to be given that we are at the level of speculating? Okay, let me give you a benchmark number. So, if you take one of the reasons that the models you mentioned earlier, like supersymmetry, became so popular, is gauge coupling unification.
Yes.
That Lepp measured in the beginning of the 90s.
Yes.
Now, you can say, okay, of course it's an accident, but if you take it seriously, and it implies that, in fact, all you need, by the way, to achieve the most important thing of supersymmetry is Higgsinos.
Yes.
So in order to work as well as it can, you cannot have those fields behavior than 100 TeV. So if you want a nice benchmark, that's one. So 500 sounds fantastic. 1,000 would be even, yeah. So that gives you an idea of the game we're in. Now we can start talking about electroweak physics of dark matter, like the WINOs, which are still TeV, and those are very, or Higgsinos that are very hard to look for. But I mean, the stage we're in now, and we are reading tea leaves right now, right?
Sure.
So I think 100 TeV is a great benchmark. So 500 sounds amazing, actually.
Right. Okay. Well, please send me some papers that would educate me on the specifics of what you were just saying.
Yeah,
just... Oh, yeah, we have a paper back now, 2012. It's called Minisplit.
Okay, good, very good.
And also for completeness, in the context of Snowmass, there has been lots of talk about this. So Patrick has been leading in part some of these talks. Lianta, et cetera, they have been thinking about benchmarks for different center of mass energies for different colliders. And 500, which is the limit, has fantastic reach to many things that people have thought about.
Mm-hmm.
So also they're talking about that in the Snowmass, CPM, et cetera.
I see. Very good.
Just doing like rough estimates, if like instead of, I mean, people have always been thinking about like normal versions of naturalness, but a lot of people have thought of neutral naturalness, which is you don't have particles that are charged the same as the standard model at one loop compared to the Higgs scale, but those list basically at two loops. And yes. Like you did rough estimates, and I mean, if you take two loops above the electric symmetry breaking scale, you'd need probably a 300 TeV collider or so to directly access those. So 500 is nice from the point of view of at least all the neutral naturalness ideas people have thrown out so far.
Yeah.
Will you send me some papers that would educate me on that?
Sure.
Great. This has been a real pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Perimeter for hosting.